Our focus this evening is on the second half of the fourth chapter of the book of Genesis. It follows on, obviously, from the first half of the fourth chapter, which describes for us Cain's murder of his brother, the circumstances surrounding it, and the outcome of it. What were the circumstances? Well, Cain, like his brother Abel, brought a sacrifice to God, an offering to worship God, to express their view of the worth of God. Abel's sacrifice was of the firstborn of the flocks that he tended, the fat portion from among his livestock. He brought the best because God was worth it. Cain's offering, on the other hand, was brought from his crops that he had harvested, but there is no indication that he brought what would later be referred to as the first fruits. It wasn't the first ingathering of his harvest, nor is there any indication that he brought the best of his harvest. In fact, while I may be reading into the text, the implication is that he may in fact have brought the worst, that which was not really fit for human consumption. Well, maybe I'm taking things a little far, but what I'm not taking too far is the reality of Cain's proud self-determination. He would live his life his way. He would be his boss. He would determine how he would conduct himself. And of course, that then resulted in rejection by God. Cain responds with anger. Anger at God, which is expressed in the murder of his brother. He couldn't murder God, though perhaps he would have liked to have scrawled on a wall somewhere, "God is dead." He couldn't do away with God that easily, but he could do away with the one who was the visible expression of God's acceptance and commendation. He could do away with his own blood brother, and he did so. So fierce was his anger at God. Cain, therefore, is punished by God. And that punishment itself doesn't draw forth from Cain any sense of responsibility for his actions, any agreement with God that what he had done was wrong, any sorrow over the life of his brother that he had snatched away, or for the sorrow and grief that it would have brought to his mother and father. Rather, Cain's response is one of self-pity. "My punishment is greater than I can bear. And you know what's going to happen, God? Someone's going to find me and kill me." Well, just deserts, we think. But God is the avenger. And God says, "No, I will put a mark on you, and no one will kill you." Cain then departed. Departed not only from his family home in which he had grown up. Departed not only from the fields that he had ploughed and planted and harvested. Departed not only from a settled life for a life of wandering, but departed from God. Well, we could argue he had already departed from God. But here is a determined movement away from God. He went east of Eden. He went away from that place in which God's presence had peculiarly dwelt. Furthermore, he went east, which, as we may see as we work our way through this book of Genesis, indicates a separation from God. Cain will be self-reliant. He will continue in the way that he has begun, in his own self-determination, away from the presence of God. And Cain's way of living is one of two ways that are described for us in this chapter. We've already seen that in part one. That is the way of Cain, the proud, self-determined way, which will flow through into this passage. And there is the way of Abel, the humble worshipper of God. Well, let us consider further the outcome of Cain's proud self-determination and see the way of life that it generated, not only for himself, but for others. It's expressed, firstly, in what happened once his family had begun to grow. We're told that Cain knew his wife, and she conceived a son and bore Enoch. Now, where did Cain get his wife? A matter of much speculation and disagreement. But if we believe the Bible, and if we take it seriously, then we understand that Cain's wife was his sister, a daughter of Adam and Eve. But did Cain already have a wife at this point? Were daughters already born to Adam and Eve? So that in the colouring picture that the children have, we see Cain wandering away from the Lord with his wife. Or did he somehow reconnect with his family later on, after his departure? Did he perhaps steal away one of his sisters from the family home? Well, we do not know. But Cain acquired a wife somehow at some point, and she conceived and bore him a son. And then we're told, when he built a city, he called the name of the city after the name of his son. Now here's an expression of Cain's self-reliance and self-determination. He built a city. Now that was in defiance of God. That itself. God had proclaimed, "You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." Cain himself acknowledges the curse that has been pronounced against him. "I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." And then we're told that he departed from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, which you may have as a footnote means wandering. In other words, his settledness was not a permanence. It was a place of wandering from one place to another. It was a life of continual movement. But after he had a son, Cain determines that this life of the fugitive, this life of wandering, must stop. And he determines himself to build a city. Now, we mustn't get any grand ideas into our heads. The Hebrew word for city here could simply mean two or three houses together. A little hamlet, a village, as much as a great metropolis. But nevertheless, we see a change here. He's settling. He's putting down roots. Furthermore, not only does he build a city, but he calls it by the name of his son, Enoch. Here is not only defiance of the curse of God upon him. I don't care, God, about your curse. I don't care what you think of me. This is how I'm going to live my life. I'll do it my way. But he also demonstrates his determination to leave a name, to create, as it were, a dynasty. He called the city after the name of his son Enoch. Now, more often than not, interestingly, in the writings of Moses, when a godly person calls anything by a name, he names it after God. I can give you one example of many that we would find in the book of Genesis, chapter 22 and verse 14. Abraham called the name of a certain place, "The Lord will provide." As it is said on to this day, "On the mount of the Lord it shall be provided." Now we could argue that all of these instances are names of places where God acted in a particular way. But nevertheless, their focus is on honouring God, whereas Cain's focus is on preserving a dynasty, a name for himself. So that's one illustration of the proud, self-determined way of living. Another is seen as the story unfolds and as we're given this genealogy of the generations of Cain. Enoch had a son, that son had a son, that son had a son, and that son had a son. And we reach the seventh generation from Adam through the line of Cain. And we come to Lamech. And we're told that Lamech took two wives. God's provision wasn't enough for Lamech. He needed two wives in defiance of God's decree when he created one wife for Adam. And then Moses says, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Very emphatic. And Lamech emphatically denies it. One is not enough. So he takes two wives. And again, we have an illustration of the proud self-determination of those who will live without God in their lives. And yet, having said that and having seen the kind of defiance of God that is expressed in the lifestyles of those who deny him, or at least will not submit to him, we note from this story that their lives are marked by success. There are four ways in which we have this expressed for us in this particular passage. We're told that Lamech had two wives. He gives us the names, and then he tells us the children of these wives. Jabal, we're told, was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal, and he was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. Zillah also bore Tubal-Cain, so this is the second wife, bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. And so we have these four areas. There's the area of agriculture. Now the very fact that our attention is brought to these things highlights the fact that they were successful in these things. They made a name for themselves in these things. One was a nomadic, but he was successful in raising livestock. Another was successful in the arts. Another was successful in what Kent Hughes refers to as technology. It's not quite the way we would think of technology today, I suppose, but he was successful in forging all kinds of instruments of bronze and iron. Perhaps he made ploughs and farming implements. But there's a hint of something more here. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron, but his name was Tubal Cain. Who was Cain? Well, Cain was his great-great-great-great-grandfather. And what had Cain done? What is Cain noteworthy for? Rising up and killing his brother. And there's a kind of a suggestion in here that these instruments of bronze and iron were not necessarily always for peaceful purposes. And then there's the fourth area of success. The sister of Tubal Cain was Naamah. Well, we're not told what Naamah did, but the Hebrew word indicates that she was beautiful. It means lovely one. And there's a sense then in which in these four children there is a picture provided to us of the kind of lifestyle that is wrapped up in success, whether it's success in agriculture, whether it's success in the arts, whether it's success in technology, whether it's success in beauty. And this is what they focus on. And this is what they've made their name in. This is what they are known for. And to a certain degree, there's nothing wrong with that, except for the fact that someone is absent. God. He's not here at all. There's no reference to God in here. There's no reference to God in the names that are given. There's no reference to God in the success that has been met with in these various categories. Moreover, the hints are there that while civilization was developing and becoming established and increasingly complex in its abilities and successes, there was also increasing godlessness. And that ultimately is expressed by Lamech himself when he turns to his wives and sings a song, perhaps with blood still dripping from his hands. Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me. A young man, a boy, perhaps. For striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. Here is a man glorying in violence. He's proud of what he's done. Some young fellow struck me, so I killed him. Furthermore, If Cain's revenge was to be sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. If Cain's revenge is to be complete, Lamech's revenge is to be overflowing. And this is the way of the lives, then, of those who do not walk in God's way, acknowledge God, or submit to God. They live lives by their own rules. They may, in fact, see great success in their lives, but ultimately their lives bear marks of violence. It's something that Asaph, in his 73rd Psalm, grapples with. He says, "Truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped. For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." What did Asaph see? He saw people out in the world who completely disregarded God. In fact, people who would raise their fist to God if they could, and they succeed in life. He describes people who have everything that their hearts could desire. They're proud people. Violence covers them as a garment, he says. They don't even worry about death. And they succeed. That is a description, again, of this way of life, a way of life without God. But there is another way of life, and it's described for us just in those last two verses of the fourth chapter of Genesis. We go back in time now. We're not in the time of Lamech. We're going right the way back to the time when Cain left his father's house, left his settled existence, left his planting and harvesting of crops just outside of Eden. And we're told Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, "God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him." To Seth also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. At that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. What is this other way of living that is described for us here? Well, in contrast to a proud self-determination, where God is defied, here we have the acknowledgement of God. Another child is given to Adam and Eve. And Eve says, "God has appointed for me another offspring, another seed, instead of Abel, for Cain killed him." Cain has shown his true colours. He can't possibly be the seed that was promised when Adam and Eve were banished from the Garden of Eden, the seed that would trample the serpent. Abel can't be the seed. He's dead, killed by the hand of his own brother. But now God has appointed for me another seed. Here is another child through whom the promises of God can be fulfilled. And you see here that there's an acknowledgement of God, but more than simply an acknowledgement of God, that there's an indication of faith in God. Everything seems to have gone sour in the lives of Adam and Eve. Can you imagine it? There they are. They themselves have fallen into sin. They've been banished from the presence of God in the Garden of Eden. Yet God has shown them so much mercy, and he has promised them a deliverer who would come from them. And here they are, they have two sons who are growing up and maturing into men and becoming successful in their own fields, and suddenly, in a day, both of them are lost. One is buried in the ground, and the other one is escaping as far away from the visible presence of God as he possibly can. Everything that they had hoped in has been taken away from them, but God proves his faithfulness. And Eve acknowledges her faith in God. Furthermore, we are given an indication that those who acknowledge God, who have faith in God, worship God. To Seth also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. Enosh means something like vapor, or something that is fragile, which may give an indication that Seth understood that man's life is fragile. But we're told that at that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. Now, I'm sure there are a number of ways that we could understand that phrase. One suggestion, which looks closely at the Hebrew text, suggests that what is being expressed here is that from that time on, people recognized that the seed was referring ultimately to Yahweh, to the Lord. That interpretation hangs on various aspects of the Hebrew. Now, it seems a very reasonable and possibly the correct understanding that there came a point where God not only is acknowledged as God, as the faithful God, but there is this close connection with the prophecy that God provided in the curse of the serpent. And all through then the scriptures we see this connection with the seed that is to be promised, and it crops up over and over and over again in covenants to Abraham and to David and so forth. But since in 6 months' time, when you come and you read Genesis chapter 4 and verse 26b, you probably won't see that connection. It won't naturally read from the text for you. Let me give you another interpretation of the text, one that is more popularly held and one that may be equally valid. And that is that at that time, people began to worship God. But more than worship God, it's more than calling on the name of the Lord in terms of praying to God, but rather, as Ken Hughes suggests, it is a calling on the name of the Lord in terms of proclaiming God to others. It's a worship of God that proclaims his worthiness. The reason for that interpretation is the fact that within the books of Moses, to call upon means to proclaim. To call something means to declare something. In fact, this is the word that is used when someone's name is given. It was used earlier. To Seth also a son was born, and he called, he declared, he proclaimed his name, Enosh. Now, what Ken Hughes argues is that when this phrase is used here, given the use of the term calling upon in the body of the writings of Moses, we have a declaration not only of prayer, not only of worship, but the proclamation of who God is. A proclamation that might, to some degree, reflect what would later be more clearly understood and expressed by God himself in Exodus 34 and verse 6. The Lord passed before Moses and proclaimed, called out, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. This is the God that was acknowledged by Eve. This is the God that was acknowledged by Seth and Enosh. This is the God that is acknowledged by this particular line, who in contrast to the line of Cain, presents us with an alternative way of living. A way of living that is not self-determined. A way of living that is not focused on personal gain. A way of living that is not devoid of the graces of God, but rather a way of living that acknowledges God, a way of living that worships God, a way of living that proclaims God to others. And both these ways of living are seen around us today. We live in a prosperous culture, a successful culture in agriculture, the arts, technology, and even beauty, if you have eyes to see it. But it's also marked by violence and the glorification of violence. Lama would have felt very at home in New Zealand in the 21st century, I think. And there is a need in this society at this time for people who live another way, for people who will make God known, who will acknowledge God, who will worship God, and who will proclaim God, people who will have faith in God and will testify to their faith in God. And who, by example, will declare what God is like. This is what Jesus calls us to. He calls us to live lives which are in direct contrast to the world. Lama had declared that his revenge would be 77-fold. Upon anyone who even simply wounded or struck out at him. Now we have an echo of that 77-fold in the New Testament. And Peter came to Jesus and said to him, Lord, how often will I forgive my brother when he sins against me? As many as 7 times? And Jesus said to him, I do not say to you 7 times, but 77 times. Jesus is saying there needs to be a profusion of forgiveness. There needs to be an overflowing of mercy to those around us. A direct contrast to the revengeful spirit of the world, but a way of living that expresses the character of God, who was so forgiving to this world that he sent his own son into this world
so that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life.
Eternal life that was purchased for them at great cost by the suffering and death of God's own Son. There is the measure of the forgiveness that we are to show to others. That is one way that we can declare the character of God. When we, in our lives, mimic God, as it were. It ties in so much with what we've been looking at these past two Sunday mornings from 1 John chapters 2 and 3. We are children of God if we are believers in Jesus Christ, and as children of God then we do not go on sinning, rather we practice righteousness. As children of God, we have the Spirit of God dwelling in us. We have a nature that has been born of God that will not continue in the proud self-determination of Cain, but rather will declare the God of Adam and Eve, of Seth and Enosh, and of generations that followed. Two ways to live. How are you living your life?